In this episode of The Critical Myth, The Critical Myth crew hits the mid-season break with Covert Affairs, entertains guests with Manhattan, puts a stake into True Blood, goes back in time with The Leftovers, and digs into this week's quick hits. It's episode 480, A Season Too Far.
We are back with episode 480, and this is The Critical Myth. I am John, your host, and tonight we have...
Edmund from Greenville, and a lot of shows seem to be taking a break on us.
Yes, and this is Gary from Jacksonville, and I agree, I don't like this midseason. I want to push through. I want to see what's going to happen. Why are they pulling the brakes on us?
And I just have to say that we should all try to be a more sensitive European man if we can. All right, we are going to be going into our more traditional episodic discussion here, and that means, Edmund, I think you need to give a bit of a disclaimer.
Absolutely. We will discuss just about anything that might have happened in these episodes, so you will be horribly, nastily spoiled. But especially with our little Dragon Con break, we've given you plenty of time to catch up, and let's face it now, we're actually in a little bit of a hiatus, so you really should have seen all these by now.
That's right, you really should have. No excuses. Okay, Gary, why don't you go ahead and give us the first choice here. What would you like to talk about?
Well, I'm sorry to see it go on hiatus. Let's talk about Covert Affairs.
All right, and here's the promo.
Tuesday, on the biggest covert yet.
What the hell is going on?
Something that can't be undone.
A traitor will be revealed.
This needs to end now.
On your knees.
And everyone will pay the price.
People are gonna die.
Covert Affairs, an all-new episode, Tuesday at 10 on USA.
All right, and if you could?
Absolutely. We're talking about Covert Affairs, Season 5, Episode 10, Sensitive European Man. Despite Augie's wishes, Annie helps McQuaid with a tough mission. Elsewhere, Haley is determined to find the truth before disaster strikes on U.S. soil.
All right, and what would you give this one?
I would give it an 8.5.
All right, and Edmund, how about you?
I will go with an 8.
Okay, hold on. For some reason, it's being strange here. Why is it doing that? So 8 and an 8.5. I would give this one an 8 as well. All right, Gary, get us started here.
Okay, well, we're reaching the pinnacle of McQuaid's plot line, I suppose. We find out, well, we had suspicions early on. It turns out, no, he really is a good guy, and that is second in command of McQuaid security has been behind it the whole time, along with some other people who we don't quite know who they are yet. They frame him for all sorts of bad things, and the CIA comes and starts to tear apart his office, although I didn't think the CIA could work on domestic proper territory, but
yes,
who needs that silly rule after all? Anyway, so Annie goes about trying to both keep him safe and prove his innocence by revealing who the person behind this is, and then at the same time we have Haley, who is dead set to arrest Annie and catch her, and she does a pretty good job at it. Yet a second empowered woman who's able to competently do her job, which is nice to see. I'm not thinking spinoff per se, but it was still nice to see. Anyway, so as we go through all this, Augie of course has severe reservations about Annie helping or helping McQuaid, but not so much to help him, but to keep herself out of trouble. And of course, Annie doesn't listen. Does she ever listen? And she eventually goes through, and we reach the point where McQuaid's trying to deal with this with the issue himself and confront his second in command. And out of the blue, she just plugs him with two shots from a gun. I was expecting more of a sort of expository exchange between them. But, you know, she chose to end it rather quickly, which was, you know, interesting and really moved the plot along. And I thought this was a really good episode. My only complaint would be that I like when Annie works with a team, and she was really flying solo on this one. And so that's a characterization of the show that I usually enjoy and I didn't like in this case.
Okay. Edmund, what would you add to that, do you think?
Yeah, for me, certainly one of the highlights here was having Sean Doyle come in as the new big bad now that McQuaid's been vindicated, or at least revealed to be a bit of a red herring. He's been an actor who I've really enjoyed in Big Love, and also there was this little Canadian series that nobody saw that got canceled after one season called An Endgame, where he's actually playing a Russian chess champion, and I'm really hoping when they come back from hiatus and they get into his storyline, they throw in a little Easter egg of him being really good at chess. But that's just a personal note. I thought they did do a nice job of wrapping up the McQuaid side of things and introducing this new element and a new enemy to go against. I do agree with Gary that it's been a kind of hallmark of this season, but this thing of Annie being more on her own, and I guess it was there it's the direction they've decided to take in the aftermath of her little her solo jaunts and being officially dead for a while and coming back, and I would like in the course of the back half of the season to see her reconnecting a little bit more and bringing more of the team back in now that she hopefully has at least convinced part of the establishment that she's okay. But naturally, I'm sure there's still going to be some suspicions. So I thought it was much as I don't like this going on break business. I thought they did a decent job of both bringing things to a head and setting things up for when they do come back.
Yeah, it's funny. This definitely felt like they were bringing the story to a bit of a proper turning point. I mean, we now know who the traitor is. We know then that there is a bigger bad out there, which, of course, that's typical for this kind of storyline. It finally looks like the whole Calder-Sidney thing is actually going to mean something. Yet, like you said, Gary, it's kind of odd that one of the downsides of having the show expand in the way that it has to being split between the CIA and this contract group for McQuaid means that Annie is kind of no longer part of just a simple team anymore. Team Annie is now spread out a lot more, which means that she's on her own a lot more. And yeah, it felt a little weird. In fact, we had a comment over on the website on bognetwork.com from Danger Mouse, a longtime listener of the show, saying that definitely didn't feel like a mid-season break or whatever it is. It's so odd. And that's really the part that I think threw me off a little bit is that it didn't have that hard cliffhanger feel that we've seen in other mid-season breaks for the show. But anything else that you want to say about this finale, or mid-season finale anyway?
I was a little disappointed we didn't see a little bit more of Joan, but there was so much going on, I understood that. And I thought Arthur came through pretty well, and looks like maybe he'll still be Annie's boss if she doesn't go back to the CIA.
Yeah, right? I guess we'll find out. Okay, so that being said, Edmund, what would you like our next topic to be?
Why don't we move on to Manhattan?
All right, Edmund, if you could.
Certainly. This is Manhattan, Season 1, Episode 4, Last Reasoning of Kings. The arrival of a high-profile guest shakes things up, and Frank is haunted by his past.
All right, and what would you give this one?
I will give this one an 8.5.
All right, and Gary, how about you?
I'll give it an 8.
All right. I would probably give it an 8 as well. But I know that you guys are more the fans of the show, so I'm going to go ahead and let you run with the ball for right now.
Yeah.
Why don't you go ahead and get us started, Edmund?
Yeah. With this one, I felt that the sort of overall balance and tone of the show was starting to come together more after some of my reservations about so much emphasis on the security aspect and the second or third or fifth class status of the implosion group. This was the one where things were feeling a little bit more balanced, and certainly the historical stuff they were bringing in, having Niels Bohr be the high profile guest showing up, and the expectations it was bringing within the groups, I thought was nicely handled, because it would certainly make sense that in that position that they would be thinking that, oh no, he's coming to join us, and this was one of those cases where knowing the historical history and the attitudes of all these people, I did know which direction it was going to go, but I did particularly like that aspect of things being introduced into the show finally of the scientists who really were not behind this project and on their own moral and philosophical grounds just really could not participate, which is actually where the title of the episode comes in, with Louis the 14th, I believe it was, putting on his canons that it was the last reasoning of kings, and the hopes that in this 20th century and with all our advancements we could get beyond just making bigger and bigger weapons. So that was an interesting perspective to bring in. And then the stuff going on with Frank and the implosion squad. I mean, I was a little bit annoyed, and we are doing this this was a few weeks ago, so I hope I'm remembering correctly for once, but I believe this was the episode where they went out to do the test again, actually got it done, and I did get a little annoyed that we had to have the camera get dropped and the evidence lost, so that once again they're having setbacks put in front of them, since I thought maybe this was going to be finally the time for them to move forward, but even with that happening, them turning it around to say, oh no, let's just go out and do it, let's just go back and do it again, at least was more of a sense of moving the actual bomb development forward rather than just constantly placing obstacles in their way. I thought overall this felt like the series starting to come together and get its themes and characters more in a row.
Gary, how about you?
Oh gosh, I think I want to raise my points after some of the stuff that Edmund brought up, because there were so many good moments in this episode. That I'll try and touch on a few things that Edmund didn't necessarily touch on. The trying to get sleeping pills, this whole little mini drama that Frank, can't sleep. He's really disturbed. He's on this project. While they haven't canceled it, he doesn't feel like they're letting him do anything. So so he's really stressed out. He wants to get sleeping pills. He's already gotten some. They're gone now, and he wants to get more. And they won't do it unless he gets a psych evaluation. So wittingly enough, they send his wife goes in to go request sleeping pills. And while I can't recall the word for word interchange, I thought it was very smart, witty, and quite enjoyable to listen to. What's her name in this? Eliza?
Olivia Williams is the actress.
Yes. The interchange with the psychiatrist, I thought was quite enjoyable, as well as her conversation with Niels Bohr about her, I guess, her potential or her studies that she was doing. I thought that was really nice. I felt they touched on a lot of broad concepts in this episode, as you were saying, Edmund, when they talk about the last reasoning of kings, and they question this whole, how big a bomb can we build? Should we bother to build one? Is there going to be another one? How long before we destroy ourselves trying to create the biggest weapon? And it really makes you think and consider what it is that they're here doing. On a positive note, we finally see things starting to go Frank's way a little bit. His associate ends up getting some extra blasting caps after the first mishap, and they're able to do it again, and hopefully with better results. So it was nice because I felt Frank has been on such a downward spiral for so long. This is finally a chance where it feels like he's getting somewhere. And so I'm glad that he's turned that corner, even if it's just for an episode or two. They can't keep him down forever and have his project end up pretty much finishing about on time with Oppenheimer's main group. So he's got to make some progress, and they've started to do that. I enjoyed how everyone respected a scientist, that the idea of someone who's accomplished something, he was, that Niels Bohr was such a superstar for this camp, as opposed to some movie actor coming over or something like that, which was almost what I expected. It was going to be a mini USO tour show up or something, even in this secret place. So the scientist angle I thought worked well for these guys. He's really is the the rock star in their world. So it was really nice, appropriate. I enjoyed how everybody wanted him to stay, and of course I think he personally finds all this research to build this bomb reprehensible, but at the same time he sees the need for it and won't criticize it to that extent. So I felt this hit in for big themes as well as small small interchanges very well.
Yeah, it's always neat to see them have somebody historically relevant show up on the show, and certainly as a chemistry geek and someone with a penchant for quantum mechanics, it was great to see Bohr in the show. That was really neat. And this was an episode that held my attention, like really held my attention. So I would agree, Edmund, with your assessment that this was really the show feeling like it was finally getting its voice. And hopefully they can continue along these lines in the future. All right, well, let's see. Gary, anything else to say about this episode?
I feel like they've moved through a lot of their opening jitters at this point. I think the actors are starting to get the characters, and they're relaxing, for lack of a better term, into the roles. So I'm hoping it gets better at this point. I'm still concerned that some of the storylines have been a bit sparse as far as moving forward. A lot of it seems like they're sort of stuck in the same motion. So I'm hoping they can keep pushing things forward. I'm concerned that they won't, though. So we'll see.
Okay, Edmund, last thoughts?
No, pretty much in agreement with what you guys have added, and yeah, it does feel like the show coming together, and I'm looking forward to see where they take it from here.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. All right. Well, Gary, I believe it's your turn to pick the next topic.
Let's see. Let's talk about let's do another finale and finish up with True Blood.
All right, and let's go ahead and run the promo.
You deserve everything, Sookie. You deserve the world.
But if all I want right now is to see you live. I love you, Bill Compton.
Love you too.
I don't want to do this.
Are you with me or not? Are you afraid?
I can't let go.
All right, and if you could do the recap, please.
Absolutely. We're talking about True Blood. Season 7, Episode 10, Thank You. In the series finale, Sookie imagines her future with and without Bill. Meanwhile, Eric and Pam have a difficult time cooperating with Mr. Gus, and Andy is surprised by an unexpected inheritance.
Okay, and what would you give this one?
Six and a half.
All right. Nadim gave this one a 6, and I would actually give it a 5.5.
Wow.
All right. Yeah, not my favorite. You never go that low. I went this low for the second episode of the season, so I guess it's appropriate. Yeah, this was not a good series finale. How did we... are we back up?
We are back up now, yes. You literally dropped right when you said this is not a good season. This was not a good series finale.
Well, it wasn't. And in particular, the problem here is that, at least for me, this series either needed to run at least another season or two, or it needed to end last year. There is no in-between. And unfortunately, this was the in-between. And so it felt like the series was in an extended wake for itself when an awful lot of people kind of had already let it go a long time ago. And then this finale just seemed to drag on forever. Despite putting a lot of time and effort into subplots that I didn't care about, they forced the whole thing with Hoyt and Jessica, which made no sense to me whatsoever. And then in the end, they have Jason end up marrying and having kids with this Bridget girl that hasn't been around but, what, 4 episodes? It made no sense.
Well, that seems so Jason.
But it was just out of nowhere. But mostly it was the, like, 20-minute-long goodbye from Bill and Sookie. And then Sookie winds up, after all of this who's she going to end up with stuff all series long, to the detriment of the show, we find out that she's just with some unidentified person. That's it. I don't know. It felt like a complete letdown.
Yeah, that felt like zero payback. Yeah, for.
Yeah. What would you add to this, Gary? I mean, you've seen this from the beginning as well, so.
Oh, geez. I mean, yeah. They dragged out the Bill thing to no end to literally have her in his coffin, stabbing him to death. And that she had to be the person that did it just seemed absolutely ridiculous. I mean, they talked about an ending to their relationship, but you know, that's taking it literally too far. I was quite disappointed with that, and I cannot believe that she actually did it either. It seemed out of character for her to do that, in my opinion. What else? I have to say, I did enjoy the sort of tongue-in-cheek take on Eric and Pam towards the end, that they became the actual solicitors of New Blood. So I thought that was a cute little ending, and it didn't surprise me. You know, if you think about it, you know, they've been selling something since the beginning of the show, so it follows that they would continue to do so. I can't say that some of Bill's ending wasn't without merit. You know, it was, you know, in his mind, you know, self-sacrifice so that Sookie could move on with her 40-year life. So he wanted to give up his 500-year life, and or at least 400 years. And so, I mean, there was a bit of self-sacrifice that was nice, but at the same time, you're right, it just dragged and dragged and dragged. And I honestly thought Jason was going to end up with Jessica. Hoyt coming out of nowhere, I just didn't get it, honestly. And you're right, as we look back on this whole season, you know, it's just been, it's like almost like a yearbook season. You know, we flip back through pages to see people that we knew, but you never really get a story on what happened to them. It just, you know, people sort of just moved on. You know, Sam left, but I guess technically we see him at the end, but we really never got a sense of what happened to him or, you know, what went on with anything. They gypped us. They gypped us with this jump forward. It's not the first time they utilized it in this series, but at the same time, I felt, geez, betrayed's too strong a term, just let down that, you know, that they had to jump to a happy ending like this, that we didn't get to see how the happy ending came. That's what this season could have been, and it wasn't, unfortunately.
Yeah, it's surprising you say it's like the yearbook season, which is exactly what it felt like, but where was Lafayette in the finale? He just, like, disappeared for no apparent reason. But anyhow, yeah, this was a disappointment, and I have to say that, I mean, last season was a bit of a jump back up in quality. This was another dip back down. It wasn't as far down as, say, the 5th season was, but it certainly was a step backwards for the whole season. It barely crept above dead average. So I'm surprised that it even made it that far. If it hadn't been for a mid-season kind of peak where they managed to get back for at least three or four episodes, they managed to get back into the right groove, I think it would have wound up being much lower. So yeah, it is what it is. It's one of the disappointments of this season, this summer at the very least, unfortunately. All right. That all having been said, Edmund, I believe you have the next choice. And actually, Gary, I think that was all the stuff that you had that you were up on, right?
Yes, it's taken me a little while to recover from our Dragon Con escapade, so.
You didn't get a chance to really talk about your Dragon Con experience. If you want to take a few moments now, that would be fun.
Oh, sure. Yeah. No, I'll sum it up. Every year is kind of a little bit different. You spend different amounts of times with different friends. Not that you don't see anybody, but it always is a little bit different. I probably got to more panels, but I chose to do panels that meant more to me. It wasn't so much a matter of checking off actors that I've seen so much as going to see actors that I wanted to. I went to go see the Being Human panel, which was hilarious. I've really fallen in love with the show over the years, and it was so nice to see the whole main cast together. And oh my gosh, if you thought they were ever cut ups in the on the show, they were absolutely hilarious in every panel, of almost falling out of your chair, taking jokes to the extreme, innuendos up and down. It was a sheer joy. I only got to see them once, unfortunately, but I regret that. I should have tried to get to see them again as I look back, because it was that much of a fun ride. You could just tell what good friends they are. You see some you go to these things and people are polite, and they'll share a joke or two that happened on set, but you always feel like they're at an arm's distance. These people were not at an arm's distance. They were hugging, kissing, at one point riding each other. It was great to see that. Another little side note that I got to see, I got to go to the Spartacus panel. We've talked about that show for several years on our little show that we do. And it was so nice to actually see these people in person and hear them talk about it and mention, talk about in person the passing of Andy from the show The First Spartacus and how much he meant to them, and it was really touching. And of course they had funny things to talk about as well, and not to mention all the cursing and nudity and stuff like that, and how I guess being naked in front of people bonds you to them. it was quite enjoyable. And it's a little known show, and I don't know that we ever talked about it on this show. Did we ever talk about Legend of the Seeker?
No, it was gone before we actually got running, as far as I recall.
Yeah.
Anyway, it was a small little show done in New Zealand. It was cheesy, and I loved it. And I got to meet the villain, shake hands, and we even hugged each other. I never thought I could ever say that I hugged Dark and Raw, but it was great to do. It was really, really one of the little thrills of the convention for me. He's a very nice man, and we talked for several minutes about what it involved. And you get into this whole talk with people who play villains. Like, what do you think? He's like, no, I was just mean, nasty, evil, and I like to screw people over, which is nice as opposed to being a misunderstood person or having your own agenda. He went right for it. So he had a lot of fun. He also talked about Spartacus. He was on there, of course, as well. So that was fun. The costuming was incredible. It always is every year. I think it actually gets better every year. I get to see new and interesting things. One that really sticks with me was this small child that was done up as a Nightcrawler from X-Men with full blue makeup and a tail that stuck up in the air. He was really enjoyable. And on a little bit more of a comedic note, there was a person who was dressed up as the Winter Soldier, except she had an Elsa wig on, so it was Elsa, the Winter Soldier, which I thought was a really nice sort of pun to play. But yeah, it's a great time every year. It gets a little busier, a little crowded, and you always have to pick things, because there's always three to four things happening at any one time you want to do. So you have to choose properly, whether it's go to see some stars in a panel, go to do shopping and pick up some new geek stuff, or just costume watch, or hang out with friends. At some point you have to sacrifice one for the other, and hopefully you find a balance every year.
Absolutely. All right, well, thanks for making it this time. I know that we're all still exhausted from last week. And still perhaps recovering physically as well, but hey, we'll catch up with you next week.
Okay. Have a great time, everybody. Talk to you later.
Yep. Take care, Gary.
All right. Well, let's see. Edmund.
Yes.
What's our next choice here, I guess?
Yes. Well, I don't know if it'll make it into the edit, but I did hear you mentioning The Guilty Remnant as we were coming out of our little technical difficulty there. So I guess we do need to talk about The Leftovers.
Yes. Yes, indeed. And let's go ahead and run a promo.
3 years ago, we looked at ourselves, and none of us wondered why we were still here. We knew. Of course we knew. You know.
I don't belong here.
Are you a good guy?
No.
She wanted to deliver a message. You need to tell me what she said.
What the fuck did you people do?
This isn't happening. This isn't real.
I have to leave here.
All right, and if you could do the recap, please.
Certainly. This is The Leftovers, Season 1, Episode 9, The Garveys at Their Best. Tom connects with his past, even though he knows it's a mistake. Meanwhile, Nora has a job interview. Kevin's father receives an honor. Troubling news comes as no surprise to Lori. And Kevin tracks down a rampaging deer, but can't seem to shake his bad habits.
That kind of leaves a lot out, to say the least. Well, what would you give this one?
I will give this one an 8.5.
All right, and I would give this one probably a 9. Yeah, I thought that this was exceptional.
Yeah.
What a lot of people maybe didn't realize or see coming was that this was a complete flashback episode.
Yes, exactly.
Taking place well before the rest of the series, really the days leading into the departure. And yeah, not to put too fine a point on it, but yeah, the Garveys were all insane before this all happened. especially Kevin. That split personality thing that he has going on was in its early stages. What maybe was equally obvious is that what's the wife's name?
Lori.
I'm blanking right now.
Lori.
Lori, yes. That Lori was already on the kind of early stages of depression as well. And part of it was this fact that she was pregnant.
Yes.
Talk about a big, whopping revelation. For a family that apparently had not lost anybody in the departure, why were they so strongly affected? Well, now we know.
Yeah.
They did lose somebody. It was just someone that only Lori knew about.
Mm-hmm.
Presumably, anyway. We don't think – I wouldn't think that she said anything to Kevin at this point because he still doesn't seem to understand why she's doing what she's doing.
Yeah, exactly.
Just to see Jill as this – completely prototypical or archetypical teenager, braces and bubbly and no care in the world, other than the fact that her parents might be splitting up. But even that seems fairly prosaic. And when you consider just all that's about to happen and just how deeply damaged she's going to be. And yeah, you just get this sense of all these people that are just hanging on the verge. And it becomes very obvious why this event broke them all.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think the biggest revelation, I mean, it was as much in the settings. I think there's been sort of this presumption that, yes, that house you see them living in now, you know, was their house. And then to have this flashback of them being in this very sort of modernist, affluent setting, and, you know, and realizing that no, they went from being this, you know, this very successful couple in the town, you know, whatever cracks and problems they were having among themselves to what we've been seeing in the rest of the series was sort of the first revelation, and then to go through all of the things that they were going through leading up to the departure. We've mentioned with Laurie, I mean, just that bizarre sequence of, yes, being at the ultrasound and then having the baby be one of the disappeared, was obviously the major one at the end. But even with Kevin, the whole thing of, you know, I mean, yeah, having this whole issue of the rampaging deers having come up then, and for all the intimations of possible infidelities to discover that yes, it was something that random and that disconnected, and then to have have his lover just disappear like that was, you know, it really did bring into focus just you know, as you said, John, I mean, this family that yes, didn't seem to have lost that much. It really was an amazing dissection of, yes, we've been wanting you to think that, but no, there were still things that could have happened and did happen that really do explain why they're as messed up as they are now.
Yeah, this just for me. I know that there are going to be people that are still going to look at this and wonder about what mystery there is supposed to be gleaned out of this, but this was, at least in my opinion, them doubling down on the notion that this is just a story about people that are damaged, and just an event that pushes them even further over the edge.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, because I was reading some comments of people saying it's like, you know, oh, you know, oh no, this should have been the pilot, and it's like, no, it shouldn't have been, because that, you know, the power of it is as much because we've been presented with them after the fact, and been presented with all these baffling behaviors, and I don't think it would be anywhere near as powerful if you were showing all of this up front, and then just following the story through, well, especially since Gary is now gone, you know, and the whole fact that once again it's sort of playing with the lost structure of things, except in this case not going back and forth, but just taking an entire episode to go through and show you, no, this is what was happening to all of these main characters leading up to that point that we showed you in the pilot. Yeah, I thought just, you know, did a marvelous job of filling in, perhaps not, you know, not that I can think of the things we don't know yet, but filling in a lot of the gaps, and it was really giving the series a structure to hang things on now, which you know, I'm very interested to see where they take it from here, and now that they've done that, and presumably pushing on, I would presume pushing on into what is to come, but it was a marvelous episode to give us that connective tissue finally.
Absolutely. And it was probably the right time going into the finale as well. So, let's see. Anything else to really say about this particular episode, other than that it really was a nice kind of cap off of all of the hints and intimations over the course of the season?
Yeah. Well, especially given the title of the episode, I mean, you know, yes, the focus was mainly on the Garveys, but also, I mean, the whole Nora sequence really was emotionally devastating in its own way, of having this morning scene of a wife just feeling that, you know, oh no, you know, her family's isn't quite there for her. Her husband isn't really supporting her in this, and she's getting annoyed at the kids and being in the grips of all of that and having them disappear right at that moment. It also really brings her character into focus as well, of just how devastating that would be to have to turn around and then deal with that aftermath when that was the last thing you were thinking before they all disappeared.
Yeah, it's really quite. It does explain a lot about her, to say the least. All right, let's see. I did want to mention that we did have, actually from Andrew A to Z over on the VOG Network forum, he just dropped this kind of in. Hey guys, love the show. Just wanted to drop you a note about something you mentioned regarding The Leftovers in episode 475.
Okay.
In the show, it is really inexplicable that Amy is just roaming about the sheriff's house. Again, if I were Kevin, I wouldn't mind that much, but anyway. I just read the book, however, and it is explained in there. Her mother isn't around, and the father is abusive and doesn't really care about her, so the sheriff took her in as sort of a boarder. Of course, in the book, he isn't the sheriff, and there is no character of his father. Okay, okay. So... Right. A little bit confusing there. But for all intent purposes, then, this is an example of the writers just not having the time to delve into the backstory of all the characters. And for that matter, I wonder if this is the writers of the show deciding that Amy has a different kind of role than she did perhaps in the book. Because while it does talk about – while Andrew here does talk about the background of the character, he's not really saying anything about what her purpose is in the story now.
Mm-hmm.
So that's interesting.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, certainly in the way she's been used in the series. I mean, it became so much of a question of her character being used as a way of intensifying the question of how sane Kevin is. It so I think this is a case where they decided let's not fill in the background precisely so. Us in the audience, as we have been doing, would be wondering whether she's actually there and what her actual role is.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. Well, let's see. What kind of time do we have left here? Where are we at?
We are at about 47 minutes.
All right. And that means that we have time to go through our quick hits. So we're going to go ahead and do that now. Let's start off with Legends. Season 1, Episode 2, Chemistry. Martin, Crystal, and Troy Buchanan go undercover when a chemistry teacher and his family are kidnapped. The case takes on urgency when it's feared the kidnappers will use the teacher to manufacture a deadly gas.
Yes.
What would you give this one, Edmund?
I will give this one a...
Uh, 7.5. All right, that's about what I would give it as well. It was it's a step up from the pilot, but I still feel like the show is trying to find its legs, and I'm kind of getting the intention of the writers now in terms of how Odom's whole thing with Martin Odom's Legends mm-hmm. are going to play a role in this now.
Yes.
It's not just about him; it's also about others, but. I still feel like they kind of need to define that better. We also have Season 1, Episode 3, Lords of War. Martin poses as an international arms dealer to rescue kidnapped chemist Richard Hubbard and track the sale of VX gas. Before long, he connects with beautiful arms trader and slips into a shadowy romance with her. What would you give this one?
I'm about the same, 7.5 again.
Yeah, I would probably give it a 7. I felt like it was a little conventional here and there. But how about you? Your thoughts on this show so far? I mean, it's coming in just a tick or so above average, but is that the impression that you're getting?
Yeah. Actually, as I've been watching it, one thing I've been realizing is I've been comparing it to Intelligence from last season. But I've been much more positive on this. I mean, not that that's a huge step up, given the fact I dropped Intelligence after about the third episode. But with this one, there's the mix they're bringing in so far of there is that whole procedural element where it's that, you know, the current case that they're working on, which they're stretching over a few episodes, and this whole background with the homeless guy who was trying to warn Martin and the cops or the one cop digging into it as sort of that ongoing arc that they're trying to bring up. I mean, it's a matter of I depending on how they develop all that, I see it as still having potential where Intelligence just started falling flat for me very early. So I am cautiously optimistic at this point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I am as well. It's still a show where we have to face it. These are the people from 24 and Homeland.
Yes.
So is Howard Gordon going to be able to resist his usual stuff? We'll see.
Yeah.
All right, if you could take the next few, please.
Certainly. Next is The Lottery, where we've got two episodes here. Season 1, Episode 5, Crystal City. The President and First Lady announce the 200 lottery finalists and prepare for the opening night reception. Meanwhile, Vanessa uncovers disturbing information connected to the kidnapping in China. Allison and James get closer to learning the truth about the fertility crisis. And Kyle and Tracy fight for custody of Elvis.
Yes, and what would you give this one?
I would give
these two anyway.
Yeah, or if you want me to just go ahead and give both recaps and or one by one.
No, I'm sorry, I was distracted and didn't realize it was that long of a recap. That's a really long recap.
Yes.
What would you give it?
I will give it a 7.
Okay, I would give this one actually an 8. I feel like this was another example of a show finding its rhythm a little bit, and Yeah, Nate is good for this one. I think they did that even more with the next episode, which is why I was kind of jumping towards that. But
okay.
Go ahead and give that recap if you don't mind.
No, it's Season 1, Episode 6, Sleep Deprived. Vanessa works against Darius to control the lottery. The lottery contestants acclimate to the pressures of their new lives. Kyle meets an unlikely new ally, and Allison's investigation intensifies.
All right, and what would you give this one?
And, this is where I would jump it up a bit to the 8 myself on this one.
Yeah, and this was, again, another 8. And, wow, this one started adding some really disturbing undertones to the show and going in the direction I was kind of hoping that it would.
Mm-hmm.
And, I'm hoping that they continue along these lines, because now they're introducing some of that dystopian stuff that they were hinting at in the pilot and then kind of backed off on a little bit.
Yeah. I mean, there was something about the sort of American Idol introduction in the previous episode that with all the finalists getting, you know, being brought in that I think was what downgraded it to me. But then the way they started out the competition and some of the conflicts they were bringing in there, I definitely agree that it was a step up.
Yeah, it was kind of like the. I was reminded a little bit of Miss Congeniality. You said beauty pageant or American Idol thing.
Yes.
But if it was written by like Christopher Nolan or something, it was like really twisted. If you know version of that, it was just really you could tell that there was something really bad going to happen here, like a beauty pageant. By way of Hunger Games.
Or if they want to make it really, really good, it'll be way of J.G. Ballard, but this is...
Oh, there you go.
This is still Lifetime, so I'm not expecting it to go that far.
All right. Let's move on then to the next show, and this is all you.
Oh, yes. Masters of Sex. We've got a bunch of episodes we've built up here. Season 2, Episode 5, Giants... Masters breaks new ground by continuing his study as the only white physician in a black hospital, but at the cost of his gynecology practice. Meanwhile, Libby is confronted by Robert over her poor treatment of his sister Carl, which is giving something away, but anyway. Betty reunites with her former lover, and Johnson struggles to right her relationship with DePaul, who is now aware of her ongoing affair with Masters. And this is actually the point where the season took a bit of a dip for me. I would... rate this, let's see, this one as a 7.5. This plotline they introduced of him going to a all-black hospital is actually one of the fictitious storylines they've introduced, and I just feel like they've been the way they've been introducing the racial storyline was rather ham-fisted. In terms of the character of Libby, Master's wife, it just felt very dissonant with the way that they'd been establishing her character previously. So I was not happy with the way this storyline was going, which then feeds into Season 2, Episode 6, Blackbird. Hendricks bans Masters from using black participants in his study, but Masters contacts a journalist to aid his efforts. Meanwhile, Johnson is forced to accept DePaul's choice to end her chemotherapy treatments. Jean learns the truth about Betty and Helen's relationship, and Libby fires Carl after discovering she lied about Robert being her lover. This one I would give an 8, primarily due to the whole resolution of the Carl and Robert storyline. Again, just felt was not handled very well. But The standout here was Virginia and DePaul and Dr. DePaul's resolution, where DePaul has decided to basically not continue her cancer treatments, and Virginia having to come to terms with that was just beautifully acted. And also the basically end of Betty's marriage to Gene was also just quite him. Handled very well, and also it was just nice to see Greg Grunberg, you know, get a chance to really show his acting chops after being introduced as a bit of a sort of a stock character. Moving on to season 2, episode 7, Asterion. Masters becomes impotent without Johnson's knowledge after learning she is continuing to have romantic relationships with other men, so he cuts off their sexual work together. Meanwhile, Masters tries to keep his new clinic solvent by borrowing against his house and offering medical services to the hotel. I would give this one an 8. Things are sort of getting back on track now that they've gotten past the Black Hospital storyline. Actually, wait a minute. It's one of those things when you're doing this many in a row. No, I would give this an 8.5 because this one was quite extraordinary in terms of after the show being sort of stuck in place for a while. This was the one where they actually managed to jump forward by about 2 or 3 years, actually managed to pull off showing that much development that much of a shift in their circumstances and relationships rather well. All that led into season 2, episode 8, Mirror, Mirror. Masters privately treats a couple for infertility. Johnson gets in over her head when she tries to beat Barbara Sanderson on her own. Libby witnesses a hate crime that is whitewashed by the police. I would drop this back down to an 8. It was nice to see Betsy Brandt come back because it really was puzzling of why an actress of her caliber coming off of Breaking Bad was in such a what seemed like such a cartoonish role just at the very beginning of the season, but then this was her return to the show and actually as becoming a participant in the study, and that was rather well handled. And the Masters and this couple who brought in to treat their infertility, with all of these intimations being made about their relationship and the possibility that this was a past gay lover of his, and then it turns out that no, this is actually his brother. It was just this is just a storyline that just seemed to scream that no, we're stealing from Mad Men and Don Draper's long lost brother from the first season. But even though the creators have sworn on Bibles or on Masters and Johnson's own text that they supposedly have not watched Mad Men because it's too close in terms of period to their own. So, this was just if that really is the case, it's just a little too eerily prescient. But the stuff with Libby and this is the return of Robert into the storyline from the previous storyline with Carl the black nanny and maid, and it's getting a little bit better in terms of their treatment of the racial issue, but we're gonna have to see how they actually handle her witnessing at least some elements of this crime. But I have my fingers crossed that they will handle it with a little more subtlety than they were doing before.
Mm-hmm. And let's see. Last one here is The Musketeers, Season 1, Episode 6, The Exiles. Aramis and D'Artagnan try to transport a young woman and her baby from a village outside Paris to the palace, but armed men abduct the child. The Musketeers then must find out who the woman is and why anyone would go to such great lengths to kidnap her son. What would you give this one, Edmund?
I will give this one an 8.5.
All right, and I would give it an 8. So 8.5, I'm pretty sure that's about as high as you've ever given this show. What was it that worked so well for you, just in brief?
I think that just the way they handled both the action side of things and all of the background politics, and this whole secret royal baby and mom returning to try and basically to take back the throne. So for all the work they've been doing of adding in backstory for the Musketeers themselves, I thought this was a nice little bit of court intrigue as well on top of all that.
Very good, very good. One thing that kind of bothered me about this episode was just the fact that the historical matchup here was a little off. So I had to kind of turn off my aversion to revisionism. But this show, if there's one weakness in my mind, it's the fact that it doesn't come anywhere close to matching up with history.
No, at
all. So yeah, I just have to kind of ignore it and enjoy it. And on that level, I think it worked quite well. One thing that should be noted, I suppose, is that some people might wonder, well, why aren't you talking about Extant? There's actually a reason. And it might play into why last season we had 40 some shows that we talked about, and so few of them were under 7.0, and wow, that's pretty surprising. Now, we're just getting better at dropping shows that are just badly performing. Yes. So for Extant, there's really no, I just found none of us really were keeping up with it or even had an opinion about it anymore. So it kind of, right now, at least on our ratings, it's already down into the below average range, and there's really no need to continue to score it. So that may just be a kind of one of those side effects of us having taste for this show's direction, is that we're just not going to waste our time on it.
Exactly.
It's a disappointment across the board. Let's just leave it at that. So that's it for this particular episode and for this week. We have a few other shows that we have to catch up on. We certainly have a lot to say, or will have a lot to say, about the last several episodes of Defiance, but not all of us were up on that quite yet, so we will get to that next time.
And so ends another epic episode of The Critical Myth. If you want to leave a comment for this show, head over to vognetwork.com. Not only can you find links to the podcast version of each show, but there is a dedicated forum, a ton of written reviews, and related articles by the crew throughout the site. For the written reviews, you can even leave your own review, so let us know if you agree or not. You can also leave comments on our Facebook page, Critical Myth, on Twitter at Critical Myth, or Google+, under The Critical Myth Show. Any and all use of copyrighted material is only intended for discussion, commentary, parody, or educational purposes, in accordance with U.S. Code Title 17, also known as fair use. In other words, please don't sue us. And of course, the statements and opinions of the Critical Myth crew are not necessarily those of the VOG network, its partners, or affiliates. But let's face it, we're probably right anyway. Until next time, watch, read, and listen, and believe in the Critical Myth.